I'm Captain Kevin Smith, and this is Throttle Up, a radio show and podcast dedicated to the proposition that critical thinking, when employed, can dramatically improve performance in whatever we are doing, enable us to solve problems that others avoid, equip us to become thought leaders instead of followers, and provide us with the intellectual resources and moral courage to support and defend America and its Constitution. Our motto is clarify, reason, win. That is, clarify the actual, employ analytic reason, and achieve mission success. Our website, throttleupradio.com, that has all kinds of information. Also, our podcast is located there, as well as iTunes. And of course, we have a blog, so please visit our website. Our support staff, Evergroove Studios for audio engineering services. They are located in Evergreen, Colorado, and Reflections Printing for multimedia support, and they are located in St. George, Utah. Our book is Critical Thinking Essentials, Quick Reference Handbook. It is available from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other outlets. Our broadcast time on Red State Talk Radio, we are on the weekends, both Saturday and Sunday, on the main channel, that's at 7 p.m., and the Encore channel, that's at 6 p.m. Okay, welcome back to another Throttle Up. This is, I think this is episode 3 of the recovery from the pandemic. I apologize for that. I've lost a little bit of track here, but I think it's episode 3. Anyway, so we are in the process of recovering, opening up our economy. And so what's happening here in my particular location, as I record this, this is from southern Nevada. We have opened up the restaurants on a limited basis. The outdoor recreational facilities, I think, are mostly open, including the golf courses. And so things are beginning to return to some semblance of normal, although it's not normal, but businesses are now opening up. Many of them that had been closed are now open again, and people are going out to particularly the restaurants. I think the restaurants, the food service industries, were hit pretty hard. The restaurants are open. Now, we did have, of course, curbside takeout service ongoing in at least some of the restaurants in where I live, but most of them are now opened. They have opened their doors, and they are offering sit-down service in their particular establishments. I don't have a lot of good information on the bars. I think the bars are open here, too, but I don't really particularly pay attention to that one. And so we are, I guess we need to talk. We need to talk some more about what is happening and what we expect to happen and how we should think about what is going on. Obviously, our lives have been disrupted. The economy is taking a serious hit, not of its own making. And that's the big difference here. I think we need to make a distinction between an intrinsic economic problem or an intrinsic business problem and a problem that is generated outside of the business environment. So this is an external threat to the culture, external threat to the society, an external threat to the economy, and an external threat to the health and safety of the citizens of this country. So how do we deal with that from that perspective? Now, we're going to be talking about that in some, you know, in some, hopefully some measure of comprehension, try to understand it from a critical thinking perspective. And, you know, this is, of course, I say this with a certain amount of humility. This is, hindsight, I guess you could say. It is 2020 hindsight. It is looking at it and saying, well, we could have done better. Yeah, I suppose that you can argue that this was inevitable because nobody was able to identify the threat, the emerging threat to this culture. And, you know, I'll give that a certain level of credibility, but I'm not sure that that's helpful either. I do think that we probably ought to have some notion or at least some emerging ideas concerning the situation and how and why it came about. What were the early warning signs that were missed, if in fact there were any? My position is that all of these, these mission critical situations or catastrophic events, all of them come with forewarnings. That's my position. And that, why do I say that? Because I was involved in a lot of catastrophe prevention initiatives in my career in aviation. And when we look at that from a sober and from a critical thinking perspective, we can see that there were early warning signs that we didn't pick up. There were situations that we either ignored, we didn't take the time to become aware of them, we didn't take the time to understand them in a meaningful way, and we were busy in the moment. We were busy doing things in the moment, and we didn't spend any time stopping what we were doing in the moment and taking a breath and looking at the big picture. You know, we did a series. Actually, we did a 10-part series on this radio show and podcast called Big Picture Thinking. And I would, you know, encourage all of you out there to take a listen to it. It's available in a podcast through the throttleupradio.com website or iTunes. You can find it there as well. And so these are Big Picture Thinking, 10-part series. I believe it's a nice piece of work, frankly. It was a pleasure for me to put it together. And I think, you know, that was done before this coronavirus situation, but I think that it probably would have been helpful if we had started to consider such a thing, let's say a year ago or 2 years ago, where we were aware of the biological laboratories, we were aware of research going on, not only in this country, but in other countries as well as China. And we were aware of this. We were aware that certain safety measures, just like in aviation, certain safety measures have to be in place in order for it to not spin out of control, in order for it not to emerge in a catastrophic way, or catastrophic events preventing frankly, preventing catastrophic events. Okay, so what we're going to do this week? Well, we got some audio clips I think are particularly important. But I'm going to start off here by reading this opinion piece, since in the Review and Outlook in the Wall Street Journal, the dates are, well, it was last weekend, which would be May 9th and 10th. And the title of it is The Economic Lockdown Catastrophe. So let me read this, and this gets our mind thinking about what is it that is going on in this country, and how can we look at currently and formulate some kind of pathway forward where we are not just reacting to whatever stimulus happens to be confronting us, but we are proactive. How can we establish some kind of a proactive position and identify the pathway forward? I like to think of it in terms of a flight plan. We don't just go out and fly an airplane. We actually sit down before we get in the airplane. We actually sit down in a planning session and we develop a flight plan. It's a fairly formal process, pretty exacting, requires a fair amount of training in order to do it well. And I like to think of that in terms of how we are going to deal with this particular situation in our personal lives, as well as the lives of our organization, communities, companies, and what have you. What is our flight plan going forward? Okay, so the economic lockdown catastrophe. Let me begin reading this in the Wall Street Journal. When we wrote, and this is, I'm quoting now, when we wrote on March 19th about rethinking the coronavirus shutdown, the reaction in elite media quarters was horror and denunciation. Well, after Friday's horrific jobs report, how do you like the shutdown now? It's a kind of a rhetorical question. Continuing, the people who said we have to sacrifice the economy to crush the virus have succeeded in the former, even as the virus will be with us for many more months or longer. The unemployment in April soared to 14.7%, the highest rate since the government started keeping records in 1948. While employers shed 20.5 million more jobs after losing 870,000 in March, the labor market's bleeding is even worse than those numbers suggest, since 6.4 million workers left the workforce. Labor participation has been trending upward the past 2 years as faster job growth drew millions of low-income Americans from the sidelines. But the participation rate has now fallen 3.2 percentage points to 60.2 since the recent peak in February, the lowest since 1973, before large numbers of women started working. Much of the media continues to treat the economic destruction as a sideshow and present a false choice between saving lives and jobs. But this is the fastest job collapse in modern history. The Great Depression drove millions of Americans into poverty and caused many suicides, and there's a substantial risk this could happen again. Mental health crisis hotlines are reporting spikes in calls, according to Express Scripts anti-anxiety prescriptions increased by a third between mid-February and mid-March. Many in despair will probably turn to alcohol or narcotics. CVS executives warned this week that delayed care could lead to a surge of non-coronavirus-related health problems. They include cancer undiagnosed and illnesses left untreated. Hospitals have also had to cancel elective procedures, which is how they make most of their money. Stanford Healthcare is cutting pay by 20% for its 14,000 workers. The California Medical Association reported that revenues at private practices have declined by two-thirds since March 1st, and half have furloughed or laid off staff. Congress has appropriated $175 billion to shore up hospitals, but this won't help small physician practices. Many healthcare providers warn they may not survive if their privately insured patients lose jobs and sign up for Medicaid, which doesn't cover their costs. Businesses are also going under. This week, J. Crew and Neiman Marcus filed for bankruptcy, and many more will follow. I would parenthetically say here that I hope that's not true. I hope that the recovery is more dramatic. That's my hope. I'm kind of encouraged that it will be. And the reason for that is not, it's not so much a, you know, a economic position. The reason for that is a, is an emotional position. It's a perception that the customers are there, and our job as a business person, our job as a provider of something useful is to fill the need, because the customers are still there. You can say, well, the customers don't have any money, you know, and we can go around and around in circles. And there is certainly that factor involved. But I do believe that, for example, I do believe that people are going to be driving their cars. They're going to need gasoline and repairs. They may be buying new cars because of sales, and they're going to go out to eat. Their restaurant visits are going to increase, and so forth. Well, okay. Continuing, ADP this week reported that small businesses shed 11 million jobs in April, according to the labor report. 8.2 million leisure and hospitality jobs, about half of the industry, have been eliminated in 2 months. Many Democrats seem to think this is no big deal, since many laid off workers will be able to collect enhanced unemployment benefits that pay more than their wages. But what happens in a few months if their employers no longer exist? The crowd that demands the economy remain locked down until there's a vaccine, miracle therapy, or daily testing for everyone in the country seems to think the government can replace the private economy. That's a fantasy, and they are betraying the very low and middle income workers they claim to represent. Average wages in April rose sharply because so many low income workers were laid off. While they blame President Trump for the economic pain, Democratic leaders want to keep the economy sedated far longer to ease pressure on the healthcare system. California Governor Gavin Newsom this week relaxed his state stay-at-home order, but most Bay Area counties have extended their lockdowns through May 31st, even though they have relatively few deaths and thousands of unused hospital beds. Even in New York City, 26% of hospital beds and 21% of intensive care units are now free. After a 7-week lockdown, thousands of New Yorkers are still testing positive and hundreds are hospitalized each day. Government has done everything it could. Society has done everything it could, Governor Andrew Cuomo said. He's right. But then why not reopen? Americans need to work to make a living, and they want to work. But the longer the shutdown goes on, the more furloughs become long-lasting unemployment. Many Americans who quit the labor force during the 2008-2009 recession took years to return, and some never did. Who knows how many won't this time? It is important to stress that the strict lockdowns were a government policy choice, but the damage is done and our focus isn't on recriminations. The issue is what to do now, and the public is wise enough to know that public health can't be sustained without a healthy economy. Americans can see the destruction all around them. They know the virus will be with us for a long time unless there's a vaccine, so we have to learn to live with it and have a functioning economy. No politician wants to admit it, but we are moving to a de facto policy that gives people and their businesses the leeway to open and make their own risk calculations. Most Americans are smart enough to know they need to make precautions and social distance, and businesses have no incentive to endanger their employees. Meatpackers are learning that lesson the hard way. The trade-off isn't between lives and livelihoods. The policy goals have to be to protect both as much as possible. Deploy more personal protective equipment, greatly increase testing, build surge capabilities to handle flare-ups, and isolate society's most vulnerable to keep the hospitals from getting overwhelmed. But for heaven's sake, reopen the economy so we don't consign millions 2 years of poverty. Okay, that completes this rather interesting article, opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal about the economic devastation that has occurred in this economy as we have single-mindedly tried to eradicate a contagion that has developed into a pandemic. Okay, we're going to take a short break and then we'll be right back, and we're going to play some audio clips that relate to a lot of this and have some further discussions so that we can understand what's going on and create some kind of a meaningful and productive pathway forward. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. Now, we're continuing, and we're going to be taking a look at a couple of things that I think are important and interesting, meaningful, as we try to come to grips with what is going on and seeing if we could make sense out of it from a productive standpoint. And, of course, we apply principles of critical thinking. We apply the ideas behind critical thinking and complex problem solving, as well as higher order reasoning and, of course, big picture reasoning. What does that all mean? It basically means that we are looking at the situation, looking at our lives, looking at the situation from a different perspective, from a non-traditional vantage point. And the reason why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? We're doing this because we are trying to become proficient in our ability to think critical. We're trying to stretch our critical thinking muscles to the point where they can function well under stress. And that's the whole idea behind this. Now, here we have, we're going to run a short audio clip of this is an interview with George Friedman. Now, George Friedman is a rather interesting figure. He's been around for quite some time, author of a new book. It's called The Storm Before the Calm. Previous books, I think he's written about five previous books. He's a geopolitical expert with a global outlook. He was founder of Stratfor, which is a forecasting firm that a lot of businesses use, a strategic forecasting firm. And he's a good source of, let's say, insight. He's a good source of information for us, so that we can consider things perhaps from a somewhat different perspective than what we're getting. Especially the mainstream media is not being helpful. They're just more or less, you know, stuck in this hysteria, the hysteria of the moment. That seems to be what they do, how they function. They're just purveyors of hysterical content, hysteria of the moment, without any kind of a broader perspective of what is going on. And that may be because they're limited from a cognitive standpoint, or it may be that they are just, that's just intentional. I don't know exactly. But doing some work in that area, and I'll get some information out soon about how to deal with misinformation in this digital age. Anyway, so now this is a interview that this news organization recently had with George Friedman. The interviewer is not particularly well versed in the subject, but we'll try to get through that in some form or fashion, understanding that there are some tricky questions here, some lack of fundamental understanding in certain areas. But listen to what George has to say. He's got some really good insight into currently what's going on. I found it to be quite helpful. And so I want to share that with all of you out there, and to see if we can maybe help us further our understanding. Here goes.
Chairman of Geopolitical Futures, which is an online publication that forecasts the international system. He joins us now live from Austin, Texas. George, great to have you with us. China is getting a head start after this pandemic, while the rest of the world is still battling those lockdowns. What kind of an advantage do you think that this would be in the geopolitical scene? Are we likely to see more aggressive actions from China?
I think China's been badly weakened. China is a massive exporter to the United States. As the United States has both a trade war going with it and now a decline in consumption, China's ability to sell to the United States declines. But also, I mean, the data we're getting out of China is not particularly reliable and has never been. So the idea that the rest of the world is floundering with this disease, which we are, and that China is somehow solving it, is not particularly, it's hard to believe. And so when we look at China right now, it's in the midst of a major existential crisis, because its government is based on the idea that it can manage the system well. And between the trade war with the United States, events in Hong Kong, now this does not seem like to be a very competent government.
The U.S. will likely try to counterbalance, but it's been hit very hard. And after all of this, do you think that the U.S. can still emerge from this pandemic as the sole superpower, especially given the fact that you hear the president speaking more and more and more about nationalistic policies? There's immigration policy, again, trying to put American workers first. And then you have the president saying we need to decrease our dependence on critical supplies during this outbreak that have been made overseas.
Well, like the president of Turkey, the president of the United States is responsible for the country he governs. But when you look at nationalism, you really have to look at what's happened in Europe. The borders have come up. There is no pretense any longer of a genuine European solution to this problem. Europe is at least as advanced economically and politically as the United States, and it has returned to the old borders that it had. And when you ask the Italians what they think of the Germans, well, not very much. As for the United States, we all are struck by this crisis. But the idea that the United States doesn't remain the largest economy in the world, the largest military, I mean, that's not true. But everybody is in a state of shock. And everybody is claiming that somehow the governments have failed, somehow the institutions have failed. We were hit with a pandemic that none of us anticipated. None of us were ready to deal with. All of us have serious problems. And one of the things that came out of this was nationalism, which is the simple statement that President Erdogan must take care of Turks, President Trump must take care of Americans, and President Xi is trying to take care of Chinese.
When you look at Europe, George, which you sort of touched on just now, you have Russia that's been devastated economically, and unity among the EU members is being tested. The EU was not there for Italy in the way that it expected or that it should have been. What do you expect in terms of changes in that region?
Well, first of all, we have to understand that Russia exports 30% of its GDP in the form of oil. The collapse of the oil prices cripples Russia's economy. It hasn't yet played through, so it hasn't been seen, but this is a serious blow to the Russians. As to the European Union, this is the first existential test that the European Union has experienced, and it's failed it, because the president of Germany, the Chancellor of Germany, must take care of Germans. And Italians are not the same. So the idea of the European identity is being tested. And what we're finding out that there's a German identity, an Italian identity, a Spanish identity, but the European identity is dissolved. And I think that's one of the most important things this crisis so far has brought out, the fragility of Europe.
George Friedman with the Geopolitical Futures. We really appreciate you being with us. Thanks for your analysis.
Okay, so that is one point of view from George Friedman, and I think it's a worthwhile point of view as we take a look at the geopolitical situation. And he does that very well globally, and we can look at that as well. And we can look at the political situation with respect to this country and its position in the world. My takeaway from that is that the United States' position in the world will not change. There are other countries that will degrade and diminish for various logical reasons, China and Russia in particular, that he pointed out. The United States will not degrade and diminish very much at all for various logical reasons as well, which is that the underpinnings are very, very solid. There is great strength in the United States, and it's not only its ability to respond to crises, its capabilities, its enormous wealth. But most of all, I think it's because of our ability to be innovative and creative, to come up with better ideas going forward. The old model, which is the command and control model that is being used in Turkey as well as in communist China and Russia and other places throughout the world, that old command and control model is simply not working. It's crumbling before our eyes. We can see it happening on a daily basis in China to the extent that we have to wade through the fake news. But once we get to the truth, we can see that this whole command and control model that they're using that is simply not equipped to deal with something of this magnitude. The resilient model that we have in this country which is based upon free market capitalism and other things, and individual freedom and free enterprises and free markets. That's much better, much more capable of responding to these serious crises and serious threats to our particular country. All right, so I got a couple of more that I want to play. This is all part of our trying to grasp the bigger picture here, the greater meaning of what's going on, so that we can carve out a productive pathway forward. All right, so let me set this up and we'll listen to another audio clip.
George Friedman, founder and chairman of Geopolitical Futures. We hope he's with us. There he is. Hi, George Friedman. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it. You know, we know this pandemic could prove a deeply destabilizing factor, not just economically, but also geopolitically. Where do you see areas of concern, you know, for areas where there may be serious change on the horizon?
Well, we've been undergoing change ever since 2008. What the coronavirus has done is accelerated and intensified some of the processes that are already in place. So China was already staggering economically and particularly hit by the U.S. sanctions. Now its largest customer, the United States, is in deep recession, not able to buy its goods and not trusting China. Russia was already in an oil crisis. Now the price of oil has evaporated, its ability to function limited. Europe has been fragmenting. Brexit has taken place, tensions within the European Union are there. Now they've come to an increasing point where, for example, the Italians and the Germans completely disagree on what needs to be done. So I don't think this coronavirus has changed the trajectory of the world. It has speeded it up. We're seeing crises all over the world that were endemic, but now intensified.
Okay, but it sounds like the most powerful countries in the world are facing obviously serious challenges, but it doesn't really change their ranking, so to speak, because people are talking about this whole new world order, but it sounds like the order might still remain the same, albeit with weakened economies and power.
Well, I don't see how China sustains its economic position in the world. It's not simply a question of challenging the United States. I mean, it was badly hit by 2008. It's an export-oriented economy. Exports dried up. Now exports are paralyzed. So the question is, how far down does China go? How far down does Russia go when oil, its primary commodity for export, goes away?
But I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I just have to ask, I mean, won't the oil price bounce back, though, once, you know, the economy starts, industry starts moving again?
Well, if you think that, then I hope you buy oil. But it's no one knows if it'll bounce
we
back.
We all do. If not directly, we are all consumers of that oil via our industries.
Russia needs $70 a barrel oil to balance its economy. It can get by with 40. It's the amount that oil has to improve is 3-4-fold to make a difference. This is a secular shift in the nature of the oil markets, driven in part by the development of American United States as an oil exporter, but also driven in part by the efficiencies that have developed in the economy. So this is not a passing thing that's simply the coronavirus. It is something intensified. But I think the world order is changing, that a lot of countries that appear to be emerging and challenging for the top position have now been badly weakened. And that is a change.
I need to address something else with you. I mean, when we look at history, and I said really our only reference point for this, it's economically, it's getting to be the Great Depression. We are seeing that level of poverty now, joblessness. And what reignited the economy in the wake of the Great Depression was, of course, war. You have certain leaders now, very powerful leaders, not least, you know, in the United States, who might be looking for scapegoats or to divert attention. Should we be concerned on that front? Might we see powerful people get reckless?
Well, powerful people didn't get powerful because they were reckless. We like to think of them as that. And every leader is trying to find someone other than himself responsible for this, and no one is. But we have to distinguish between what a recession and a depression is. A recession is a cyclical event primarily financial. A depression is when the economy itself is destroyed. The businesses are gone permanently. Jobs have disappeared. Food is not available. This is not yet a depression. And in benchmarking it, we should draw that distinction. It may become one if this isn't solved soon. But I'd look very hopefully at some of the medical developments that have been made in the United States, Europe, and China, that we may find a mitigation to this before we go into recession. So I think we have to be very careful not to overstate what's going on. It's a terrible thing. But if you look at the Great Depression, it was horrible. This is not yet that.
Okay. But, I mean, your hope is that medically the situation will be solved in time for it to become a Great Depression. So we really do have to pray that a vaccine does become available, or else this could sink us into the same position we were in the 1930s.
It doesn't have to be a vaccine. It can simply be something
more
like
treatments. Absolutely. Yeah. Let me ask you, though, about, you know, something we're seeing, and we were just talking about South Africa there. You know, we're seeing up to 4-kilometer lines of people just waiting for food because they can no longer feed themselves or their families. Food security was becoming an issue, particularly in the developing world, even before this pandemic. Do you think we are prepared as a global society for those kinds of shortages? You know, even in the United States, when we're looking at the president insisting that meatpacking industries stay online, even while there's a huge risk for their employees, they need to ensure that food is delivered and deliverable to people and still affordable. Is that being managed to make sure that a true crisis in food doesn't break out?
Well, I'm very cynical about this idea of a global community responsible. Each leader is responsible for his own country. South Africa has gone through a very difficult time leading up to this and therefore suffers greatly. But South Africa, I think, also has an opportunity here, having faced the abyss, to pull itself together politically, socially, and economically and say, it can't be like this. But the problem with much of the developing world is it's waiting for somebody from the outside to come and solve its problems. And by now, this far after decolonization, we have to face the fact they're not coming.
Okay. I do have time for one last question. So I just want to get your final outlook for the United States. You seem, as I said before, that you think a medical solution to this will come sooner rather than later. Are you optimistic then about the U.S. economy, not just pulling itself up, but if it does, therefore pulling up the rest of the global economy because it is the number one top consumer on the planet?
The United States is going to go to 2-3 very difficult years. But firstly, it is consuming its own products, and that drives its economy. And unfortunately for the world, the way it will solve the problem is by decreasing imports. And that's a problem for other countries that export to the United States. But the United States, make no mistake about it, is going to go through a economic crisis of significant proportions, if not a depression, but also a political one. We have an election coming. And in this election, there is deep social division in the United States of what should happen. And this will become a very tense period in American history.
George Friedman, great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, so we have that perspective on the short-term and long-term effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Some of the questions were a little bit hard to deal with, but that's just the nature of what we are faced with as we try to sift through whatever information we are getting, whatever information we are receiving. Okay, so we've got time for perhaps another short audio clip, and I thought we would listen to a bit more from George Friedman. He's his new book out, The Storm Before the Calm. It's also, I think, of interest to all of us, particularly those of us who support critical thinking and big picture thinking. And we'll listen to some of this. We have time for a portion of this rather interesting interview. But I thought it would be good because we're kind of focusing on Mr. George Friedman and his insights and his expertise geopolitically. So let's listen to this.
Welcome to Off the Shelf, a book discussion by the Conference Board. And today I will be speaking with George Friedman about his latest book, The Storm Before the Calm. Hello, my name is Bart van Ark. I'm chief economist at the Conference Board, and welcome to another edition of Off the Shelf, our book discussions at the Conference Board. And today I have the pleasure to have a conversation with George Friedman. George is the founder and chairman of Geopolitical Futures, which specializes in geopolitical forecasting. Prior to 2015, Friedman was the chairman of the global intelligence company Stratfor, which he founded in 1996. Friedman is the author of 6 books, including the New York Times bestsellers The Next 100 Years and The Next Decade. And he lives in Austin, Texas, but is with us today here in New York. And we're going to speak with George about his latest book, The Storm Before the Calm. George, welcome to our podcast series, Off the Shelf.
It's good to be here.
Great. So actually, this is my second conversation with you, George. In just a few months, we spoke back in November about the geopolitical forecast for 2020. And we then discussed your sobering forecast that 2020 might become a really difficult year because of increased economic dysfunctioning, rising social tensions, ongoing troubles on the trade side, downward pressures on production and everything else. Today, of course, we'll take a much broader look and a bigger picture and look at your latest book, The Storm Before the Calm. However, before we go to the big picture, I'd like to briefly discuss where we are. We're now sort of, you know, almost 2 months into the new year. And at a time that it seems that the biggest short-term threat is actually coming out of left field, as is so often the case with crises, and that's the coronavirus. That was not on our agenda back in November. And while we don't, of course, at this point know what exactly will happen, the fact is that the situation is not under control and it worries enormously from a perspective of global impact and the human cost that we're paying for that. So the question I want to start with, actually, is whether these type of events like the coronavirus, totally unexpected, whether that fits into the grand scheme of things, or would you say this is just a short-term thing, irrespective of the human cost, which we don't want to play down, in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't play a big role?
Well, I'd say, like stress, viruses like this reveal the weakness of the system. The issue here, and I'm not an epidemiologist, so I can't possibly tell you about coronavirus, but when I take a look at the different impact on different countries, I look at China. What's interesting is the manner in which the system spasmed. It didn't know how to deal with it. That first, the apparently Xi knew about it or didn't know about it for 2 weeks and did nothing publicly because he was doing brilliant things privately. Then they began to cordon off entire cities. So when you look how a natural disaster is handled by a government, well, it doesn't tell you much about the natural disaster, but it tells you a great deal about that government. Our view of China has always been that it was vastly overestimated in its modernity, that it had had an extraordinary period of economic growth, but that it was a dead cat bounce. That is, it was so left in such poor conditions by Mao that they were going to grow. And that as they grew, massive dysfunctions within the economy and within the relationship of the economy to the government were revealing themselves. Well, that really is a question of what is the relationship of the government to the people. And the coronavirus tests that. And we see what the government is. It is falling back on its comfort zone of repression. And that's China. So yes, it tells you a great deal. And whether it speeds up the compression of China, the decline of China, if you will, that's important. But China had topped. China could not sustain itself at the level it was. It was going, as Japan had, going backwards. And the only thing the coronavirus does then for them is speeds up a process that we're already underway.
Yeah. So I think what you're basically saying, yes, an event like the coronavirus is coming out of left field. You can't predict it, but the way it's been handled, the way it is relating to the institutions and the governance of the country, that is something that you could see coming and that would face China at some point in time. That's what you would have expected.
And it gives you a prism through which to look at what's happening.
Right.
So the fact that the virus happens, well, I don't know where it goes or what it does. The fact that I can tell something about the Chinese government, that's important.
Yeah. Well, this is a good segue in what we're going to talk about, which is the book, The Storm Before the Calm, the America's Discord, the Coming Crisis of the 2020s, and the Triumph Beyond. It's a huge topic. But nevertheless, first of all, I have to say it was a fantastic book to read. It's very well written. It's consistently argued. And it's a tour de force to cover more than two centuries, including the tensions of today, and an in-depth look towards the future. So in about 250 pages. So congratulations. It's a major piece of work. Interestingly, I want to start today with a quote from the last page instead of the first page. This quote says the following. America is a country in which the storm is essential to clear the way before the calm. Because Americans obsessed with the present and the future have difficulty remembering the past, they will all believe that there has never been a time as uncivil and tense as this one. Now, I'm a European and have lived there most of my life, but having lived for more than 12 years now in the United States, that feels a little bit true quite often when you look at the discourse that we're having every day. I think you describe that specific characteristic of American society to the fact that America, in contrast to countries in Europe or in Asia, is an invented nation. And there are three components to that invention, as you describe. It's the regime, it's the land, and it's the people. Why are the aspects of being invented, or perhaps being reinvented over time, so important to understand Americans' present and future?
We feel a moral obligation to invent. Our obsession with the technology, the obsession with the structures that we change, and this is who we are. Because all of us came from a place that didn't want us there, or where we didn't want to be. We are all, no one said, well, I have $50 million, I think I'll become a settler in the Midwest. We came here because we'd failed elsewhere. And we came and reinvented our lives. And there was a huge degree of amnesia in that, or changing memories where things were worse than they ever were there. But we have a strange relationship to reality because we're moving away from it. Well, as we succeeded, the impulse to invent, to reinvent, is always there. And all inventions and reinventions reach their endpoint. And those of us raised within the context of one technology, one regime, one economic process, feel an enormous loss when it leaves, because that's what comforts us. And they always leave, and they always change. And so we must reinvent a new life. And it's a period, it's something within the American soul that is urgently trying to create something new. And the tragedy of American life is that the thing that's created always becomes obsolete. And when it becomes obsolete, as this period has, then there's rage, there's sorrow, and there's the conviction that this is the worst of all times.
Does the invented nation have something to do with American dream, which everybody's talking about? And if that's the case, I mean, there's some people who say the American dream is dead, it doesn't exist anymore. Does that mean that we're actually seriously threatening the inventiveness of the American nation?
I don't think it's threatened. I think the challenge is always there. Remember, we've gone through this process of institutional change and social change many times.
Okay, that completes another show, and we will see you all next week. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here, and I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service, and I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.